It is Thursday, May 8th, 2014. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. The Rogers Historical Museum presents Hog Wild, Our Area's Love Affair with the Pig, on exhibit now through August 9th. This exhibit features the museum's collection and private collections, reflecting the broad appeal of the pig in Arkansas, from farming, sausage-making, art, and Razorback memorabilia. Located in historic downtown Rogers, 621-1154, or rogersarkansas.com/museum for more information.
Support for KUAF comes from Greenhouse Grill. Featuring a seasonal menu of organic, locally grown produce and all natural meats, plus organic beer and wines. Live weekly music and full service catering available. Located at 481 South School in Fayetteville's Mill District. And on the web at greenhousegrill.com.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, we visit the tradition surrounding Ozark foods, and we learn the secret to a perfect pot of beans.
Plus, we continue our series with the gubernatorial candidates in Arkansas with a talk with Asa Hutchinson. The former congressman is seeking the Republican nomination.
Those stories and more, but first, President Obama is promising Arkansans in areas devastated by last week's tornado that the federal government will be there to help them rebuild. Yesterday, the president toured a hard-hit neighborhood in Valonia, meeting residents, first responders, and emergency workers.
You know, more than any disaster, it is that dedication, and that commitment to each other that truly defines this town. As one resident said, we just say a prayer and then get to work. So the people of Valonia and all the other towns devastated by the storm understand there's a lot of work that remains to be done, but I'm here to remind them that they're not doing this work alone. Your country's going to be here for you. We're going to support you every step of the way. You are in our thoughts and prayers.
President Obama assured disaster-stricken residents the government wouldn't leave until the area has recovered from the storm's aftermath.
The federal government's going to be right here until we get these communities rebuilt. Because when something like this happens to a wonderful community like this, when it happens to all of us. And, you know, we got to be there for them.
The president was joined for the tour by Governor Mike Beebe, Congressman Tim Griffin, and Senator Mark Pryor. Governor Beebe praised the response by the federal government.
Right now they're doing what they should be doing. You recall, I think, how critical I was of FEMA back in 07 when I thought they were woefully inadequate after the Dumas tornado. But since then, they've done a great job. And so if I'm going to bust them out for doing a bad job, I need to acknowledge when they do a good job, and they're doing a good job.
Meanwhile, FEMA is opening a disaster recovery center in another hard-hit community, Mayflower. Recovery specialists will be on hand to answer questions and assist those who felt an impact by the tornado.
State finance officials told legislators yesterday that trends in revenue collections and economic forecasts do not warrant any adjustment in the official revenue forecast for fiscal years 2014 or 2015. Department of Finance and Administration Deputy Director Tim Leathers said one reason adjustments aren't necessary is because Arkansas correctly anticipated the impact of federal tax changes by reducing related revenue projections.
I think we're pretty close on target. Unlike a lot of other states we're seeing around the country that didn't do that for whatever reason, we don't know. And now they're having a shortfall as a result of it and having to deal with that. And there'll be more reports of that as they close out their fiscal years. All of them don't report on the month. But the states that didn't realize that or chose to ignore that are suffering at this time. So we did not do that.
The sparsely attended joint committee of the Economic and Tax Policy Committees generated a few questions about the expected surplus at the end of the fiscal year. Finance officials did not give a firm estimate, but suggested it may be between $50 and $70 million.
Little Rock-based Windstream posted less than favorable first quarter earnings. For the quarter that ended March 31st, the telecom and network service company reported revenue and sales of nearly $1.5 billion, a decline of more than $31 million from the same quarter 1 year ago. Net income also dropped from $52.3 million a year ago to $16 million for the first quarter this year.
Although some expected him to get the top lobbying job with the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, State Senator Johnny Key has instead been chosen to serve as the Associate Vice President for the University of Arkansas System. Key has represented Mountain Home in both houses of the state legislature and has been in the Senate since 2008, where he has served as chairman of the Senate Education Committee and vice chairman of the Joint Budget Committee. In his new position with the UA system, Key will coordinate the system's governmental relations as an assistant to Melissa Rust, the vice president for university relations. No specific start date has been named yet, but Senator Key will reportedly begin in the position after the end of his term in the legislature at the end of this year.
It may come as little surprise to those who have been paying attention to the Fayetteville Planning Commission and the City Council recently, but it's now official. Whole Foods has officially announced it intends to open its first Northwest Arkansas store in Fayetteville. According to the City Wire, the Austin-based grocer confirmed the store in an earnings report earlier this week. The store will be built near the intersection of College Avenue and Millsap Road at the site of a former car dealership. Earlier this week, the Fayetteville City Council voted to spend $150,000 to install a new traffic signal for the planned shopping center. When complete, the Fayetteville store will be the second Whole Foods in the state and will be one of 500 stores the grocer plans to have open by 2017.
An Ohio-based supply chain solutions company will soon buy a part of the vacant Whirlpool manufacturing site in Fort Smith. Spartan Logistics has announced that it intends to acquire the nearly 620,000-square-foot warehouse and distribution facility at the Whirlpool site. Spartan currently has a dozen employees in Fort Smith, but when the space is fully utilized as part of the company's expansion, Spartan's Fort Smith operation could employ as many as 200. The company provides many supply chain services such as packaging handling, light manufacturing, packaging assembly, inventory controls, and other needs.
Early voting for primary and judicial elections well underway in Arkansas. As of the beginning of the day today, the Arkansas Secretary of State's office reports 20,847 early ballots have been cast and nearly 2,700 absentee ballots have been recorded.
Forecast calls for partly cloudy skies tonight with a 70% chance of showers in northwest Arkansas, a 60% chance of showers in the Arkansas River Valley with overnight lows around 63 degrees. Tomorrow, Friday, mostly cloudy with a 40% chance of showers and thunderstorms, a high of 76 in northwest Arkansas, and in the Arkansas River Valley, a 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms with a high near 82.
This is Ozarks at Large. It has long been common knowledge that athletes and workers who are consistently outdoors during the summer months need to stay hydrated. Now, researchers at the University of Arkansas can quantify the effects of dehydration on the body with a new environmental chamber that was officially opened yesterday. Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis was on hand for the unveiling, and he has this report.
The environmental chamber in the Human Performance Laboratory looks like a walk-in freezer with windows, and the interior atmosphere can be controlled in a way similar to that of the chamber's commercially used cousin. Matt Gagno is the director of the Human Performance Laboratory in the College of Education and Health Professions.
The unique thing about this is that it can maintain a temperature anywhere from 39 to 111 degrees Fahrenheit, very precisely at whatever temperature we set. It also will maintain humidity between 30 and 75%. So needless to say, we can make it pretty miserable in there if we want. Most importantly though, by able to control these environments, we're able to actually collect some very important physiological and psychological data. And so it's a standard in our field that we have this kind of control, and it's we're very grateful that we have it here now at the University of Arkansas.
One of the researchers who will be using this experimental chamber is Stavros Kavouras. While Kiko Haydar of the Razorback basketball team cycled away on an exercise bike inside the chamber, Kavouras explained the different types of human performance data that can be observed with the chamber.
We can finally control the environmental conditions. We can really record very precisely how much he's exercising, how much power output he's producing, what his heart rate, and a lot of other parameters. We can also even see distribution between his pedaling, whether one of his foot is pedaling stronger than the other. So the 51% versus the 49 or 52, 48 It gives us how much power comes from the right versus the left side.
Kavouras says that researchers can also take more advanced measurements, such as an athlete's pedal stroke, to see how much force the athlete is generating with each cycle in the chamber. But researchers aren't limited to just observing athletic performance data.
Of course, we can measure also metabolic data. Like you can see in the screen, we have data regarding how much oxygen his body is using while he's exercising. And we can also calculate based on these numbers, we can calculate what type of energy substrate his muscles are using, whether he's using more fat or more carbohydrates.
Kavouras says that the important thing to note is that during exercise, humans generate a lot of heat.
And not only that, just because we generate a lot of heat, humans can sweat as much as a gallon of sweat per hour. So we're talking a tremendous amount of water being produced in this environment. That's why it's so difficult to really finally maintain the environmental conditions.
Taking all of this into consideration, Kavouras shared what research he aims to target using the environmental chamber.
One of the first questions that we're very much interested in is looking at the effect of mild dehydration or mild hypohydration. So we refer to that when people, just because they're not used to it or they forget to drink much, they tend to be chronically at a low water level. So we're very much interested in looking what are the physiological responses, both on exercise performance and in health as well, of this phenomenon of mild chronic hypohydration.
And studying hypohydration, or dehydration as it is commonly called, is just one application for the environmental chamber, which was repeatedly referred to as cutting-edge technology in the field of human performance research. And university officials applauded the chamber's completion, as the $200,000 research tool represents the college's push to become a top-tier research university. Sharon Gaber is the provost and vice chancellor for academic affairs.
This environmental chamber will help keep the Human Performance Lab on the cutting edge of new research. And as the chancellor mentioned, as we're talking about being a top 50 public research university, we've set an ambitious goal of reaching $250 million in research expenditures by 2021. We're very pleased that the College of Education and Health Professions is doing its part to help us reach that goal.
And with cutting-edge research technology, like the Environmental Chamber in the Human Performance Laboratory, Gaber, Gagno, and others are hopeful to attract more high-quality graduate students, as well as research partnerships across disciplines with other departments on campus and with partners in industry as well. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
In just over 10 minutes, our series with Arkansas gubernatorial candidates continues with Asa Hutchinson. He'll give us his views on issues such as taxes and the private option.
Well, most importantly, in 2010 and beyond, I have been opposing the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. I've opposed it because it's an infringement on individual liberty, it hurts small business, and it takes our health care system in the wrong direction. Now, the courts gave the discretion to the states as to how to implement one aspect of it. They've affirmed all of it. We have some discretion when it comes to the Medicaid expansion. And our more conservative legislature and the governor determined that this private option, which is binding on the private insurance market, is a much more conservative approach.
That's still ahead here on Ozarks.
It was recently announced that Haas Hall Academy, a public charter school in Fayetteville, has been honored as one of the top 20 schools in Arkansas in terms of graduation rates. With a graduation rate of 100%, Haas Hall was among traditional public schools such as Elkins High School and Rogers High School. Though charter schools are increasing in popularity and notoriety, as Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda reports, the funding for such schools is not on par with other public institutions.
Since the first charter school was established in Minnesota in 1991, more and more of these schools have popped up all over the country. During the 2012-2013 school year, public charter schools enrolled more than 2 million students in more than 6,000 schools in 41 states plus the District of Columbia. Although they have become more popular in the last two decades, charter schools are not funded at levels comparable to traditional public schools. According to a new report titled Charter School Funding Inequity Expands, the funding disparity between traditional school districts and charter schools has increased more than 54% in 8 years. Megan Batdorf, one of the researchers who worked on this study, says of all the states in the report, only 3 received a grade of an A or a B. This ranking was based on the weighted statewide disparity per pupil. That means that 28 states have disparities of more than 15%.
Another thing we found to be really interesting about this disparity and the amount that it's grown over this 8-year period is the fact that charter school enrollment has increased in every single state in the study in D.C. over this 8-year span, while district enrollment decreased, sometimes by a lot, in 16 of the 30 states in D.C. So that's a pretty significant finding, that where charter schools are needing more money as they're growing and expanding, they're getting less in comparison to districts as district enrollment is shrinking.
The new report, which was made possible by a grant from the Walton Family Foundation, was worked on by researchers with the School Choice Demonstration Project, which is based within the Department of Education Reform at the University of Arkansas. According to the study, the School Choice Demonstration Project is an education research center devoted to the nonpartisan study of the effects of school choice policy. To collect data for this report, the research team gathered and reviewed audited financial statements from the 2010-2011 school year for the District of Columbia and the 30 states with substantial charter school populations. According to the study, after tracking all the revenues committed to public charter and traditional public schools from both public and private sources, the research team identified a funding gap of about 28%. This means the average U.S. public charter school student is receiving about $3,800 less in funding than the average traditional public school student. According to the report, of the 4 major sources of revenue for public schools, the largest source of the charter school funding gap is that public charter schools only receive an average of $1,780 from local government sources, while traditional public schools receive an average of $5,230.
For many states in this study, the lack of facilities funding for charter schools contributes a lot to the disparity. And generally that's a large portion of the local revenue disparity that we find in a lot of states. And in particular, Arkansas, because charter schools in Arkansas are not eligible by statute to receive any local dollars, that facilities funding is definitely a big part of that.
According to the report, Arkansas statute limits charter school revenues to state and federal tax sources only. Charter schools don't have access to local tax revenues, which includes any local revenues raised beyond the required mills for foundation funding. The study found that statewide, Arkansas's 17 open enrollment charter schools received about 26% less funding than district schools. Jay May, another member of the research team, says one conclusion of this report is that state funding needs to be recalculated.
State funding mechanisms must be rebuilt to take us where we want to go, which is simply equitable funding for all public schools. The White House landmark is state constitutions. Our basic framework was built around the fact that every state constitution addresses K through 12 education. They use different words, but essentially they're saying that the state needs to provide a uniform system of education, and essentially they're talking about equitable education. State funding equity is headed in the wrong direction. So we must recalculate and reconsider state funding mechanisms.
The report is available online at uaedreform.org/charter-funding-inequity-expands.
That report was filed by Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Kyle Kellums.
Warmer weather and sunny skies lead to many taking part in more outdoor activities. This month's fundraising events are also heading outside. Tomorrow and Saturday, Compton Gardens in Bentonville will host National Public Garden Days with their annual native tree and plant sale, among other events. Tomorrow, Dr. Al Einert will offer a talk on the folklore of Ozark trees and plants from 11 a.m. to noon. That's followed by a preview of the plant sale for supporters and volunteers of Compton Gardens. Saturday's sale will be open to the public, as well as many family activities such as a hike and hunt for trees and a wood-turning demonstration. peelcompton.org for more information and a list of available plants. The gardens will also host a wine tasting event May 17th.
Washington Elementary's 11th annual tour of homes is Saturday. Members of the community are invited to tour six homes within the Washington School District. That's in Fayetteville. Homes include an early 1930s and a modern condominium. Tickets are $25. All proceeds benefit the school. You can search Washington Elementary School's 11th annual tour of homes on Facebook for a list of the homes included in the tour.
The 19th annual greening of the garden is Tuesday, May 13th at the Botanical Garden of the Ozarks. This unique gala begins at 6 p.m. when guests are invited to tour the 12 gardens and enjoy drinks and hors d'oeuvres before dinner is served on the Great Lawn. There will also be a raffle and silent auction. bgozarks.org for tickets and more information.
Open Avenues will host its 17th annual Spring Fling Golf Tournament and Luau the 16th and the 17th. The organization opens Avenues to adults living with disabilities. The Luau is the 17th. Side note, I will be honored to be the MC at that event.
I didn't even know that.
Well, there you go. You can learn more at openavenues.org.
Yet another golf tournament is Monday, May 19th. It will take place at Pinnacle Country Club to benefit the Northwest Arkansas Children's Shelter. There will be a four-player scramble with a chance to win whole prizes. NWACS.org to enter.
And May 30th at Shadow Valley Country Club, Beat the Heat Summer Swing. All proceeds go to the Kendrick Fincher Hydration for Life Foundation. KendrickFincher.org for information.
The fifth annual Singing for Space picnic will take place Saturday, May 17th from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. at Dog Party USA in Taneytown. This fundraising event benefits Spay, Arkansas, the region's only low-cost spay and neuter clinic that has the aim of reducing the number of homeless pets and those euthanized. Since opening just over 3 years ago, Spay, Arkansas has fixed over 13,000 animals, drastically reducing the number of unwanted pets in the area. Marcia Donnelly is the founder of the organization. She began raising funds for this mission over 7 years ago and is still an active volunteer and involved in the daily operations of the clinic. Donnelly says she has recently conducted a survey of seven animal shelters in Benton, Washington, and Madison counties and reports a 24% euthanasia rate in 2013. That's down from over 50% just a few years ago.
It's got to have made some kind of difference, at least to those animal owners and those cats and the dog. I think that there's less puppies and kittens on Craigslist or in the newspaper or out in front of the grocery store. Things are really improving in Northwest Arkansas, generally speaking, which is great. And I hope we're part of that. I think we are kitties, like, no.
The day of my visit was a slow one, with just 26 patients served. On a busy day, the clinic sees upwards of 50 sterilizations, with a record of 72 feral cats in one day. Many neighborhoods and businesses have a feral cat problem, and Spay, Arkansas offered a $10 apiece spay and neuter to try to control that population. They were unsure of the event's popularity because people would have to trap the cats the night before. They were shocked when 72 came in. Spay, Arkansas partners with other members of the community and organizations such as the Humane Society, Keeley Farms, Lee and Kendra Davis, and the Blue Moon Cat Shelter for other programs that have also proven to be successful, such as offering reduced prices for the sterilization of black animals, pit bulls, and chihuahuas.
Population that we need to address is the ones that are the biggest you know, intake in the shelters. So that would be pit bull lab crosses, pit bulls, big black dogs. I mean, those are the ones that come in and don't get adopted. And Springdale, there's a lot of chihuahuas.
Spay, Arkansas also sees animals from Oklahoma and Missouri because of their extreme low cost to the community. Thanks to donations from individuals and businesses and events like Singing for Spays, they are able to offer these services. And thanks to volunteers. About half of the staff, including two vets and two vet techs, are paid employees. But the remaining workers are all volunteer. Many are full-time, as Donnelly is. And each has a soft heart when it comes to our furry friends. Their help to the community doesn't stop with spay and neutering. They also offer assistance in finding foster and permanent homes to orphaned animals. Donnelly herself has three dogs and many more cats she's taken in.
Last week, the Rogers shelter brought in like 8 cats. We work closely with several rescues, and two rescues came and looked at the cats, and we found homes for all of the cats. Romaine, the manager, has been working a lot with the Madison County Shelter and rescuing dogs out of there, and that's been pretty great. At least 10 have gone from here to Colorado, and we'll spay and neuter them and give them their shots and their heartworm tests. And
she's also helping a family who recently moved to the area and purchased a farm. They want more animals. A welcome client to have, as spay is in the business of no more unwanted pets. Since opening in 2011, their prices have risen just $5, and anyone meeting their income requirements are welcome to utilize their services. As they expand their programs, Spay Arkansas is also trying to offer more education about those services and programs and the ramifications of leaving an animal unaltered and unattended.
Those puppies, a litter of 11 or something, what are they going to do with it? So, besides taking it to the shelter, if that's their plan, that's not really a very good plan. And I think a lot of people don't realize how many, you know, pit bulls and pit crosses there are, and how unlike, I mean, they love them, so they don't see why somebody wouldn't want to adopt their puppies. They don't know that that's probably not going to happen.
Spay Arkansas's 5th annual Singing for Spays picnic fundraiser will take place next Saturday evening at Dog Party USA in Tawnytown. It is $25 a person. Dogs are free. Barbecue, chicken, and brats will be available, as well as beer and wine, with music by Kevin Banach. For more information, visit spayarkansas.org. This is Ozarks at Large.
Earlier this week, we heard from both candidates in the Democratic primary for governor. Today and tomorrow, we'll hear from candidates in the Republican primary. Jacob Kaufman, with our content partner KUAR in Little Rock, talked with Asa Hutchinson, the former congressman, DEA director, and undersecretary of Homeland Security, faces Curtis Coleman in the GOP primary for governor.
Arkansas's current tax structure has lower-income residents paying a higher percentage of their income than wealthier residents. Your tax plan lowers rates for lower-income residents, but also costs about $100 million or so a year. How do you plan to make up that difference?
Well, I've focused all of our tax relief on the middle income. You've got to start somewhere, and that's the right place to start. So if you're making between $20,000 and $75,000, you will have targeted tax relief under my plan. It does cost us $100 million of recurring revenue, but we have that surplus to kickstart it, and Governor Beebe has called my plan prudent. He's pretty conservative when it comes to fiscal matters. And so, you know, we balance the budget in Arkansas. That's obviously the first priority. You don't want to drift from that. You've got to fund education, our essential services. But even with that, our tax cuts can happen. And it's really important because my purpose is, one, to help the Arkansan who's paying a high percent in taxes, but also to be more competitive in job creation. What I mean by that is that we have almost a 7% individual income tax rate. Our surrounding states that we compete with are much lower than we are. And so we've got to lower it gradually over time so that we can be competitive in bringing industry into our state and keeping our entrepreneurs. So it's a good start. The motivation is job creation. I think my plan is responsible, it is doable, and it's very specific and targeted toward the middle-income folks.
This last fiscal session, the legislature seemed very hesitant to use too large of a percentage of that surplus fund. And I know you can't see into the minds of the legislature, but do you think $100 million of that surplus they'd be willing to set aside for tax cuts?
Oh, I do. And of course, elections make a difference. A lot depends upon who gets elected this year. But if I go in there with a governing Republican, conservative majority in the state house, they've been in the mood for tax cuts. They've implemented a start toward tax cuts in the last session. And so I think we will continue that. The key is to be responsible in the way we do it, again, that we don't hurt education and other essential services. But clearly, I think they will be supportive of that. And I applaud the legislature because the last session, they could have spent all of the surplus, but they didn't. They kept back $100 million. I hope that it grows this year, if our economy does. So I think that's a good start and a safe cushion as we go into next year and looking at my tax plan that I would want to present.
And could you articulate your position on the private option a little bit? The private option is Arkansas's plan to use expanded eligibility and funds from the Affordable Care Act, originally intended for the federally run Medicaid program, but Arkansas has chosen to pursue using those funds to purchase private insurance for low-income residents. Would you have supported that plan back in 2013 as it was coming up and more recently in the fiscal session?
Well, most importantly, in 2010 and beyond, I have been opposing the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. I've opposed it because it's an infringement on individual liberty, it hurts small business, and it takes our health care system in the wrong direction. Now, the courts gave the discretion to the states as to how to implement one aspect of it. They've affirmed all of it. We have some discretion when it comes to the Medicaid expansion. And our more conservative legislature and the governor determined that this private option, which is binding on the private insurance market, is a much more conservative approach. And so I stayed out of the battle when it was being considered in the legislature. But now that they have adopted it, I look to the future, and I see this as a somewhat of a pilot program. It's about half as large as it was intended to be. And the question is, can we afford this over the long term? Certainly it's providing some health care benefit to our citizens that are in the lower income categories. It is helping our rural hospitals, but can we afford it over the long term? And that's something I will measure, and to me that's a concept of a pilot program. So we'll address that in the legislative session and look at the cost of it long term, not just for now, but for our future generation.
One more question about that in particular, about your position, as it would have been if you were in the legislature in the governor's office back then in 2013. With the projections they had in mind then that you had access to, were those numbers that made you comfortable, that would have made you advocate for the program?
Well, I would have done it differently. Had I been in charge, I would have devoted a special session of a legislature to this. I would have waited longer to see how all the changes in Washington are impacting us and what some of the other states have done. So I would have addressed it differently. But I didn't have a vote then, and so I intentionally said, my battle is in 2015. Let's see what the legislature does. They have acted on it. They have passed it. They have supported it. They've funded it now. And now let's see how it works. But I assure you that regardless of the affordability of it down the road, I also want to look at further reforms. To me, any social program, and this is providing insurance for the working poor, needs to be incentive for people to work rather than a disincentive for them to work. And to me, that's a test that is very important and a value that's important in our society.
That was KUAR's Jacob Kaufman speaking with Asa Hutchinson. He's one of two candidates seeking the Republican nomination in the primary for Arkansas's gubernatorial race. Tomorrow, we will hear from Hutchinson's opponent, Curtis Coleman.
One, two, three.
Next time on Ask Me Another, NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Trivia, we hit the road with Amy Mann and Ted Leo, who paid tribute to the city of brews and brats.
Walked over the bridge in Milwaukee, past the statue of Bonds in the dirt.
I'm your host, Ophira Eisenberg. Game on.
It's Ask Me Another, Saturdays at 11 a.m. on 91.3 FM.
It is May 8th, 2014, a Thursday. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas, and here with me now, Becca Martin Brown, features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Another sure sign of spring in Northwest Arkansas.
Well, we've already talked about craft fairs and festivals.
The Great Passion Play is back on stage in Eureka Springs. You know, they had some troubles a couple of years ago and almost shut down.
They did.
And the Gospel Station Network from Ada, Oklahoma stepped in, raised the money they needed, and they've got all of their critters back, plus two new camels donated by Wild Wilderness Drive-Thru Safari, and things are back to normal on stage. The Great Passion Play area also offers an interactive living Bible tour, the Sacred Arts exhibit, gift shops, and the Bible Museum, which, I didn't know this until I read this story in my own section, includes an original 1611 King James Version and a single page from a Gutenberg Bible. That's pretty amazing
that
in Eureka
cool.
Springs. The shows continue through October 25th, and tickets are $11 to $25. You can find out more at greatpassionplay.org.
Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Christina Thomas. The 6th annual KUAF Fulbright Chamber Music Festival begins May 15th at 7:30 p.m. in the Stella Boyle Smith Concert Hall in Fayetteville. U of A's music department faculty and guest artists will perform Brahms' Horn Trio, Rutter's Suite Antique for flute and piano, and Shostakovich's piece Trio in E minor. Admission and reception are free. FulbrightSummerMusic.uark.edu for more information.
Walton Arts Center's Artisphere, Arkansas's Arts and Nature Festival, presents The Adventures of Alvin Sputnik, Deep Sea Explorer, May 13th through the 17th. This one-man show uses digital technology to tell the story of Alvin saving the human race in an ecologically challenged future. Tickets and information available at ArtisphereFestival.org.
You have your pick for getting out of the house this weekend. Something is happening in almost every city in the area. Ozark Folkways in Winslow will host Heritage Day weekend Friday and Saturday. Tomorrow, Susan McBay will perform, and there will be a pop-up art show by Lisa Jo Outlaw. Friday night's events are indoors and have a suggested donation of $5. Saturday is the actual 21st annual Heritage Day, a celebration of local culture. The activities running from 10 a.m. until 4 include demonstrations of quilting, rug hooking, and basket making. For more information, 643-3791.
Saturday night, Shannon Wurst will be on stage in Springdale at the Art Center of the Ozarks. Concert begins at 7:30. You can learn more at artcenteroftheozarks.org.
And there's more music Saturday evening in Eureka Springs. The Ozark Chorale will host their annual Spring Sing Fest at the Eureka Springs Auditorium. The chorale, comprised of local singers, has been performing for nearly 20 years. The Saturday night concert begins at 7:30. Tickets are $10 for adults, and students are admitted free of charge.
And the opening of the fountains at Lawrence Plaza in downtown Bentonville is Saturday. The official opening of the 80 water jets scheduled for 9 a.m. Saturday morning. If you can't make it, then don't worry. Fountains will be shooting water from 9 a.m. until 10 p.m. every day until September 15th. Excluded from that schedule, first Fridays of each month when the Splash Park will close at 4.
And if you prefer something indoors this weekend, we have a giveaway.
Yes, we do.
For 4 tickets to Trike Theater's production of Cinderella Confidential. That event opens on Saturday at White Auditorium on the NWAC campus in Bentonville. There are 2 performances Saturday, and that concludes Sunday with a matinee performance.
But wait, there's more.
There is more.
Not only do you get the 4 tickets to Trike Theater's Cinderella Confidential, we'll throw in 4 Malco movie passes and 4 tickets to any Naturals game at Arvest Ballpark.
That's right. So 4 tickets to the performance of Cinderella Confidential of your choice this weekend.
Right.
4 tickets to a Malco movie.
That's right.
And 4 tickets to any Naturals baseball game.
That's right.
And all you have to do to enter.
Yes.
Is go to, email ozarksatlarge@gmail.com.
ozarksatlarge@gmail.com for the family pack.
And you'll announce those winners tomorrow.
Yes, we will.
All right.
The band is the Yellow Jackets. I'll feature their music on Shades of Jazz this Friday at 10 p.m. I'll also feature music from the Sons of Brazil, Hogtown Hot Club, and Claudia Berson. An entire set of music dedicated to bands you'll be able to hear at the KUAF Summer Jazz Concert Series. At Shades of Jazz here on KUAF 91.3 FM, National Public Radio.
Velda Bretherton has been writing historical romance novels for many a year. It is through her research for her stories that she found a love for history. Bretherton has also written 6 nonfiction books, one of which is titled Ozark, Meals, and Memories. Growing up in the Boston Mountains, Bretherton remembers many a meal cooked by her mother and aunts, such as beans and cornbread, squash jam, and possum. Bretherton will take part in a panel discussion at the Fayetteville Public Library this Saturday during that organization's Flavors of the Ozarks event. It's part of the Arkansas Department of Heritage's Heritage Month. Bretherton stopped by the Carver Center for Public Radio last week to talk food with me. She says Ozark food and Southern food don't really differ all that much.
Southern food has a lot of seafoods that we don't have because of New Orleans and the food that you get from down there. But other than that, there's not that much difference. It's just good old-fashioned Southern cooking. Arkansas is the South as well as the West. So you find pinto beans and fried chicken. And I have a lot of things in the book that are a little unusual out of the Ozarks. We used to eat, you're going to cringe, but we used to eat possum and coon when things were tough. And there was even a big yellow woodpecker, hammerhead woodpecker, that they used to eat. I talked to a gentleman who said when his family got really hungry, the boys would go out and hunt for these hammerhead woodpeckers, and they'd eat those. But we never did. I never recall that. And I don't have that recipe in the book, but I do have a little story about the gentleman who told me that. I did a lot of stories in the book from interviews.
And so you ate possum and raccoon when you were growing up?
Yeah, and as a young child. Of course, we left Arkansas when I was 5 or 6 years old, so I don't really recall a lot of this, but my mother continued to do a lot of that kind of cooking even after we moved to Kansas, where we could get some of the foods.
So we're talking maybe like the 1940s or 1940s,
late 40s.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, I've had squirrel and dumplings before. Mm-hmm. So would your mother cook the possum kind of like that? Like put it in sort of a soup like that?
Possum is so greasy that they would boil it first, and then they would bake it like a roast or something, usually with sweet potatoes or something around it that would pick up the flavor from the possum. Deep in the Ozarks, that was a staple food for a long time because they were so available. But a lot of people now say, oh, that's terrible to eat.
Well, we think it's roadkill. You know,
yeah,
that's how most people picture
right.
it.
Right. But those are the most unusual things. And of course, the recipe book that I have, we have a little section on the Boston Mountain type cooking. And then the rest of it is just things that my mother gathered. Tomato dumplings was a favorite of my son-in-law's mother, so they shared that recipe with me because my mother never made tomato dumplings.
Well, so how are tomato dumplings different from the chicken and dumplings and squirrel and dumplings that I'm used to?
Well, it was sweet and had cinnamon in it. Some people didn't put the cinnamon in, but it had sugar, and you put that in your dumplings and just dropped them in the ripe tomatoes that you had cooked, boiled on the stove like you would boil chicken or something, and then drop those dumplings, those sweet dumplings, in. My mother liked to put cinnamon in them.
So it's a tomato broth instead of a...
Right.
Yeah,
yeah, there's no... it's more of a dessert type, but you ate it along beside chicken. It was delicious because it had that little sweet taste to it. So that was a favorite of hers, and I picked that up from her. But most of them are from my mother.
You said you focus, there's a section in your book that focuses on the Boston Mountain cooking.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you mentioned the tomato dumplings, but are there some other dishes that are different?
Most of your squirrel fried okra is, I think that, of course, you find fried okra in all of Southern cooking. But my aunt used to make green tomatoes and fried and okra that wasn't fried. She cooked them until they were thick. I never liked it very much because the okra would make it slimy, stringy. But when she made it, it was good. I never was able to make it. It just never turned out right. But green tomatoes and okra were something that I didn't find any place else in recipe books. Now, it could be there are places out of the Boston Mountains where people ate. But they ate a lot here of just pinto beans and cornbread. That was just a staple. Almost every meal, they just cooked a pot of beans alongside whatever else was being cooked. So that's an unusual thing.
Pinto beans, cheap and easy, right?
Cheap and easy, right. And they cooked them from dry. All of this is from scratch cooking.
Do you think that we're at risk of losing some of these Ozark traditions and food?
I think so, yeah. Just like we're losing the accents, we're losing the traditions in the food because people just don't have the time to do it. And that's understandable. We have a different lifestyle today than they had then. And they could grow everything. Squash was something they cooked a lot of. I have a zucchini squash pancakes. Zucchini squash bread, they used, because you can grow those big zucchinis just by the tons. And there was a joke went around, you know, don't leave your car unlocked on the square during the summer because you'll find a big bag of zucchini in there when you get back if you do, because people had to get rid of it.
It so grew so.
Yeah, it was like a weed, you know, once you got it started.
I like zucchini and squash bread.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's good.
My mother even made a jam using zucchini.
Oh. Do you have dishes that you still like to cook today?
I still cook beans, and but since I work all day every day, but I work at home, so I put them in the slow cooker and let them cook overnight in the slow cooker, and then they're just perfect the next day for a midday meal, which is when we eat our big meal. And I still make cornbread, not all the time anymore, but I still do, and I like to make bread. My mother had several bread recipes that are just really good, and I like to make those. Those are some of, and fried chicken. We still like fried chicken, but it's difficult to go from scratch anymore on a lot of that stuff. But I do home make my noodles like Mother used to make, just roll them out on and cut them and let them lay there and dry and drop them in the chicken. Things like that I still like to do, but I'm guilty of not being near as good a cook as she was, but I do like to prepare things like that once in a while.
Is there a dish that today kind of characterizes the Ozarks?
Oh, goodness. Just one dish. I don't know that there would be a meal, maybe. I think probably the meals that most characterize the Ozarks are meals that were served at dinner on the ground when they had the decoration days, because I think decoration days are really still held more in the Ozarks than any place else. There may be other places in
Meaning
the South.
Decorating cemeteries?
Where you decorate. Mm-hmm. They go out in the morning, clean the cemeteries all up, and the women all bring food, and everybody eats on the ground on quilts. And that's why it's called dinner on the ground. And it's not dinner on the grounds, as you'll hear people say. It's dinner on the ground, originating because they sat on the ground to eat. Now they eat at tables, of course.
But essentially a picnic.
It's a picnic. Ozark people didn't go on picnics. My uncle used to, or do barbecues in the yard. My uncle used to say, why would I want to eat in the yard? I can eat in here at my dinner table. And so they didn't do that, but they went to all the different decorations. And everybody brought the dish they were the best known for making. Potato salad was a big, big dish. My aunt used to make iced tea in a wash tub. She'd put a big chunk of ice in there and make the tea and dissolve the sugar in the hot tea and then pour it over that chunk of ice. and there was that big tub for everybody to dip in and get iced tea. But that was mostly for decoration and homemade ice cream. They always had a hand-turned churn for homemade ice cream.
Well, and my mom still makes, well, she doesn't hand churn it, but she has ice cream makers, and every, you know, for 4th of July, she makes homemade ice cream.
Yeah, it's delicious.
We've talked a lot about the beans and cornbread.
Mm-hmm.
What is the secret to, you know, a perfect pot of beans and the, you know, best batch of cornbread?
Perfect pot of beans, you should soak them overnight first, and then rinse that water off and start them. And you just have to put ham in them. Ham hock or bacon scraps or something. I usually just save the ham bone from a ham in the freezer and just drop the whole thing in there, and then I pull the bones out, and everything that was on them is in the beans. To me, that's the best pot of beans, and it always was for any cook. And a little bit of salt, because the ham is usually salty enough. And then cook them until they're done. Really done, not still, you know, rattly on the plate. They should be soft. A lot of vegetables we like crisp, but not pinto beans. Cornbread, my husband and I are always at odds about that. He likes his cornbread with no sugar and more cornmeal and very less flour because he wants it dry and crumbly. I like mine like a cake type that raises up. And so I use sugar and baking powder in mine. But when he makes it for himself, and he does, he doesn't put but a little tiny bit of baking powder in it. And it should have some either bacon grease or lard in it, because that's where you get the flavor, the old-fashioned flavor of cornbread. And a lot of people won't use bacon grease or lard, but it really doesn't hurt you to put a little bit in the cornbread.
That's fine.
A tablespoon or two, well, and it has a good flavor.
And you need to make it in a cast iron skillet?
I usually bake it in a cast iron skillet, yeah. A small one for just the two of us, and then I've got a larger one that I use when I'm trying to make a big batch.
Well, I'm conflicted because I like it crumbly and not sweet when I eat it in chili or with beans.
Yeah, right.
But I like it with honey and butter on it, and then I want it kind of sweet.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And you want to cook it till it's really got a crispy edge around it, which it'll do in a skillet better than it will in, a glass baking pan.
Velda Brotherton currently lives in the Boston Mountains she grew up in and is the author of Ozark Meals and Memories. Brotherton will take part in a panel discussion during Saturday's Flavors of the Ozarks event at the Fayetteville Public Library. She will be joined by Kat Robinson, Tim Nutt, and Pauline Arnold. Following the discussion, there will be a Dutch oven cooking demonstration, and guests will be able to sample the foods prepared. Susie Stevens will offer a writing workshop at 1 p.m. to help folks capture memories that are linked to food. The library is also asking for submissions to a digital cookbook. Enter your Ozark-inspired recipe by May 17th. 479-856-7250 for more information. This event is sponsored in part by the Department of Arkansas Heritage. This is Ozarks at Large.
Support for KUAF comes from Westwood Gardens, celebrating Mother's Day with hanging baskets, garden gifts, and blooming roses at four locations in Northwest Arkansas. 442-3500 or westwoodgardens.com for locations or more information.
Safe water ensures good health and quality of life. The Beaver Water District, a member of the American Water Works Association and its partners, monitor and protects Beaver Lake, the drinking water source of Northwest Arkansas. Drinking Water Week is this week. Consider pouring a glass of water and hailing a toast to Beaver Lake. You drink it every day. More information at bwdh20.org.
Support for KUAF comes from Vetro 1925, offering classic Italian dining with a touch of sophistication. Located just off the square in Fayetteville, Chef Dirks and his staff strive to preserve simple, bold flavors using fresh ingredients. VETRO1925.com for reservations, catering, and private party information and more.
And this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Greenwood.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Thanks so much for listening. I'll be back with Antoinette tomorrow.
And we'll close today with Foley's Van, recorded inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio. They actually will be at George's tomorrow night.